podcast presented by the German Design Council. Our host, Martin Pauli, talks with experts about the major transformation fields in architecture: circularity, new materials and technologies, automation and digitalization, and business models. Marty is the global circular economy services leader at International Consultancy Arup, and in this role develops strategies for circular design and business model innovations. He is also a member of the Innovation Advisory Board of the German Sustainable Building Council.
So welcome to the new NDN podcast of the German Design Council that will explore and discuss the current and future role of architects and their practice and its potential to tackle some of the most pressing global challenges. The German Design Council has initiated this format to influence and to inspire and to make the impact of designers and architects in this context more visible. So if you've recently been to the Isefjord Center in Greenland, or you walked through the Wadden Sea Center in Denmark, you will have experienced the spaces, the materials, the surfaces, and the views that were designed by our guest today, who's been named Architect of the Year in 2021 by the German Design Council. So welcome, Dorte Mandrop.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Dorte, what's your favorite project at the moment? What are you working on?
Well, there are several projects that we're working on that are really exciting. One of the interesting projects we're doing right now is a project in Aarhus, Denmark, which is a market hall that is a little bit below ground, and the market hall is all about repair shops and recycling. And on top of the market hall, there's a public plaza, so people can view the harbor and the water.
Fantastic. I'm really curious to learn more about the repair shops, because you're already mentioning an important topic that we could also touch on during this podcast, which is the move to a more, conscious view on the value of materials, on resources, on buildings, components, systems. We might touch on that later. But interestingly, I mean, if we look at the current architecture, engineering and construction sector, or we say AEC sector, that seems to be facing quite a comprehensive transformation, if you like. There are global challenges. There's global pressure on climate change, on climate adaptation, resources are scarce, and there's also an increasing labor shortage, at least in Germany, for instance. So I get the sense, and I'm also trained as an architect 10 years ago, there seemed to be an emerging tension between traditional and future concepts that could reshape the way we design and construct and maybe even operate buildings, districts, and cities. Can you also feel that tension? I mean, what is it? What are the day-to-day questions that you're dealing with?
Well, the most important question, of course, or the challenges, is about the climate crisis. And I think that's actually a global problem that we as architects are able to address. There are also other global problems, like an increase in inequality, but that's more a political question. So where we have absolutely direct influences on the climate crisis. So that is definitely the most important question today.
Yeah, I really appreciate that view, because I got the feeling that if you look at the past decades, that architects have been turned into an ever kind of slower corner of the room, no? Because everything has become so technical, and also the sustainability agenda has been dominated by technologies, by building services and by PV and whatnot. And I always had the feeling that the architects are kind of losing more and more impact, even though they have quite a strong voice. You mentioned it. The construction industry, buildings account for 40% of global CO2 emissions.
Yes.
So who, if not the architects and kind of all the other relevant stakeholders, kind of need to influence that? Is that your thinking?
Yes, I do think that we have a possibility of influencing. And I think that, at least in my part of the world, I think that the architecture business has become also more technical. I think we need, as architects, practices to be much more technical, and we need to have more specialized knowledge inside the office. When I started out 20 years ago, it was like all-round talents that could actually go from concept design to building details, and I think that's not possible anymore. I think we need to have larger offices, and of course there's a possibility also that these offices become more impersonal, and that is of course the challenge in having larger offices. Mm-hmm. But you need to have the inside knowledge to be able to face the challenges we have today. So I think architects' offices, at least here in Scandinavia or here in Denmark, because there's of course also a difference between Swedish, Danish and Norwegian offices, but there is a need to be more professional and to have much more specialists inside the offices. And that's what we've been doing, I think, for the last 5-10 years, is with growing the office also to gain more specialists inside.
Yes, that's interesting. And I mean, how would a usual client brief look like? I mean, what would, if you also compare that to 10 years ago, maybe, did that change? So do you need to respond differently now with your approach
And it's certainly much more complicated. I think the competition briefs or the client briefs are much more complex. It's much more demanding, which is also, I think, a bit of a problem for the business, is that we need to prove everything before we even get assigned. And since sustainability is a much more complex affair than just, you know, there's no quick fix. There's that you need to really work quite a lot along the way to understand what is the most sustainable answer to this question. And I think that's maybe not really understood. I think there's also a big difference between different countries and their experiences, or different parts of the world and their experiences with sustainability. So we work more and more internationally. And I think that the knowledge that we take for granted here is not necessarily granted in another part of the world. So I think there's a need to have a much more open source understanding of sustainability. I think there is a need to have much more discussions around the right solutions. And I think right now we have this, the timber answer as the only answer for any kind of building. And I think that's not necessarily true. As I said before, there's no quick fix. So it is extremely complicated, and we need to share knowledge because time is running out. So we need to, in a way, open up the box and share knowledge and experiences to be able to evolve much quicker.
I really hear what you're saying. We are dealing with complex questions, and there's no right or wrong, and there's no simple answer, regardless if we're talking about climate adaptation, circularity. There are always kind of many answers to one problem. And in that sense, you somehow need to be able to kind of to argue, obviously, the pros and cons, to obviously also have a bit of evidence to back your decision making up. But I think that diversity in thinking and still allowing many perspectives, that's obviously one of the biggest challenges now. And you were mentioning timber. Yes, I mean, we see that trend. And from a pure, let's say, carbon perspective, it can be the answer in many instances. But as we were also discussing in our pre-discussion, if we look at architecture, at buildings that could, for instance, last for 300 years, then timber might not be the only answer to the question, and carbon might not be the only indicator. So how do you kind of convince a client? I mean, if he would challenge you in that way, what is it kind of, what is it that you are focusing on that your kind of, that reflects your attitude towards sustainability?
Well, it's actually quite difficult. I think there's also a difference between doing competitions and concepts and convincing clients during that quite short period of time, and convincing clients through a process when you are actually the detailed drawings. So when you do competitions, I think it's becoming a little frustrating, because usually you have a jury. They might be convinced that there is one answer, or they might not have the knowledge to evaluate all the very complex questions. So right now, I think we have a challenge in trying to understand that this process is really, really complicated, and that we need to work together with our client to actually create the best result. So in that sense, competitions are maybe not the right answer right here.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, you also mentioned another aspect that really struck me, which is the, like, let's say, the honesty and the openness, making things, I mean, your learning in a project, for instance, publicly available to kind of to accelerate things. We also see that in our practice, that many people are constantly reinventing the wheel. And if we look at 2030 and 2050, we cannot afford anymore to reinvent the wheel. We somehow need to come to a situation where we are sharing those lessons learned openly, that someone can build on it,
yes,
and then shares it back, and
yes,
you can continue building on it. But how would you describe the architecture space? It is a competitive space, isn't it?
Yeah, it is very competitive. And that means that sometimes, like you say, reinvent the wheel, or sustainability becomes like a buzzword, and we're not sharing the knowledge that we gain. So it's much more like a one-liner. This is the most sustainable building. And we all know that you can't say that. You can't say this is the most sustainable building, because you need to know what are the terms.
Yeah.
I think there is a real frustration. I think right now here in this office, we are quite frustrated that it seems that when we work in different parts of the world, that the knowledge is kind of reinvented all the time. If you go to the States, you would talk about, you know, running a building, how much, you know, the CO2 footprint
in
the operational part of it. And right now, if you go to London, it's much more about reuse. So there's these kind of two simplified ways of thinking sustainability.
And that's interesting. We also perceive that there are regional differences. There's a context like Europe, maybe even Scandinavia, that is fairly advanced, yeah, that has moved their focus from all these operational energy questions towards more, I would say, material-related question. What is the actual energy effort that is in a material? How can we treat it so it ages gracefully? How can we kind of keep it at the highest possible value also at the end of life?
Yes.
I mean, all that end-of-life thinking, that's something that... Yeah, I'd also really encourage the entire sector to adopt. And you're right. If you look at other regions, they're not as advanced. And that has many reasons. Policy, for instance. But I mean, what is it then for you? I mean, what is your focus when it comes to sustainability? Because I get the sense that every architect and every architecture practice has their own, let's say, attitude towards it. So how would you define a sustainable building for your context, maybe even here in Denmark?
Well, I think one thing is about the scope, you could say, the way you actually think a building. I think the flexibility and the possibility of change in the future for a building's use, I think, is very, very important. And I think that's probably been part of our way of thinking for many years, that you need to be extremely careful how you use space, so you don't waste space as a resource, and that you actually work with the conceptual ideas so there is a flexibility. It doesn't have to be a boring, boxy space to be flexible, but that there is a possibility of change in functionality, so it's not so specific. And I think that's part of a sustainable thinking, but it's also about very much, I think it's, of course, we do life cycle analysis on all our projects, but there's also possibilities of making mistakes, you could say, in when you do life cycle analysis, because it's still not that evolved. I mean, if you take timber, for example, the way you do life cycle analysis, the timber is supposed to be burnt in the end. Instead of standing for 300 years, there's a life cycle for timber in these programs that you use. And which is, you know, not necessarily true that you need to reassemble a building after 30 years or 40 years. So there's also different ways of thinking, of course, you know, you're reassembling or being able to divide materials is one thing, but you could also think of a building as being something that is there for the next 300 years.
Yes. And it's interesting because if I looked at some of your buildings, they leave the impression they could be there for hundreds of years. And in a way that, for me personally, makes me feel much more comfortable, because I have the feeling, I mean, you still take care, obviously, of carbon and of the materials, and that's all good. But what you were just saying is right. We are currently trying to reduce the complexity towards very few indicators, and, and that creates some kind of safety and security, obviously.
And
we are creating a bit of a comfort zone here.
Yeah.
But honestly, I believe it's much more complex. And the aspects that you were mentioning, I agree with them 100%. If we kind of continue making building adaptive to future changes, that they can accommodate an office building as well as a kindergarten, that's in the end maybe much more sustainable. If we deal with existing buildings in a way that kind of we respect what's there and really also change our behavior towards it. Can we use those structures? Because all the energy that is embedded into those structures is quite a lot. And I get the sense that these are all questions that ultimately enable you to have more influence on the sustainability agenda.
Yes.
And that's probably something that I'd like to hear, if you also feel that influence. Is that something where you...
I think right now we're doing an interesting project in Sweden on the harbor front. It's a quite large project. It's 35,000 square meters. It's a timber construction with a base, because it's right on the river or the harbor front. So it's really a harsh climate. So the base is in concrete and the rest of the building is in timber. And the client is very interesting because they have extremely ambitious goals on sustainability and they have the knowledge as well. So what they have is they have a bank for, you know, doors and windows and materials, walls. And so the upcycle or the reuse is quite easy to do because the client is actually up for it and they have the facilities to do it on one hand. But on the other hand, the building is a mixed use building and we don't know how much of the building will be housing, how much will be offices. And I think that the client agreed from the beginning to make the ceiling height of the building, you know, 1 meter higher than you would usually do for housing, meaning that the building can be used for anything. So I think ceiling height is a simple answer. I think also, of course, when you do timber, there's always a discussion on span. You know, when you have a larger span, you have more flexibility. So in a way, weighing that, you know, how is the construction? Do we need a larger span to ensure the flexibility in the future? So you can't just say, well, the building is only measured on the CO2 footprint. You have to understand that you, in the future, will need to reuse the buildings that we're doing today. And how do we do that? So the best or worst example is, of course, parking buildings, because they have a ceiling height that's not usable for anything else than cars.
That's interesting. And I also like to learn more about that project, because the topics that you mentioned are kind of pretty much in line with the type of questions that we need to answer. You were talking about adaptability, flexibility, also technical questions like floor to ceiling height. Yes, because I mean, if we need to accommodate different services in the future, then we can allow for it. We can allow for different uses. I guess you're also optimizing the building for different life cycles, because that's also something that we experience, that if we appreciate that the different components in each building have different life cycles. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a building structure that could last for 300 or 400 years.
Yes.
But there are building services that might need to be replaced after 25 years. Yeah. And what I want to say is, these are all design questions ultimately. That's something that you can influence in your design. And in that sense, you can influence the sustainability, the circularity of a project quite drastically, even without adding loads of technology to it.
Yes.
Because that's the point, no? These are all passive measures, if you like.
Yeah, and I think that is about architecture and design. And it's not just about flexibility, it's also about value, you could say. I think there's, our office works very much with the notion of creating place, or creating identity, you could say, for a place. And that doesn't mean making flashy buildings. It means that you have a possibility of adding value in a context. And I think that's, if you look at the Wharton Sea Center, or you mentioned the Icefield Center, it's very much about creating place. It's very much about underlining the existing qualities, you could say, but also creating new possibilities for collective understanding of place. So like the Icefield Center, the idea of being able to move over the roof or over the building is not just a funny idea. It's about continuing the landscape that's there and actually creating a space, a viewpoint, a certain identity for this place. And now it's actually being used. People get married on the roof, and you know, they use it as part of their path going out into nature. So I think that's really a success in our terms.
It's interesting. Yeah, because it already tells a lot about kind of where kind of the entire discussion that we just had can also go to. I mean, we were talking about kind of regular buildings or spaces and then more sustainable, but what's coming? I mean, can we adopt more kind of regenerative thinking as to what can a building do in a space? What can it actually give back to nature, to a community? And I think these are the questions that we should ask ourselves in the future. And you were talking about kind of that local community engaging. And I don't know, in the next project, you might thinking about biodiversity, or can the building actually clean air or filter water? No, I mean, and that is also somehow contradictory to the kind of the current thinking of moving things to zero is probably not enough.
No.
You probably need to kind of to give something back.
Yes.
And what is it that buildings can give back? And I think you gave quite a great example. So could that lead to a potential vision? I mean, if you're now a practitioner with a lot of experience and with fantastic projects, so I mean, how do you imagine a kind of preferable future or vision for the built environment? What's your thinking?
That's a very big and very difficult question. But I think from my point of view, I think that it also has to do with ethics in a way. When you do build, you know, you are interfering into the environment in so many ways. So I think it has to be meaningful what you do. It has to, you know, you cannot do a building where every aspect of the building has to be meaningful, functionally or emotionally. So I think there's a care. And of course, again, that sounds banal, but you need to be extremely careful with everything you do and be extremely careful when you use resources. And it has to be important, otherwise it's not worth it. And I guess that's not a vision. It's just a way of working or way of thinking. I think that is important, because I've seen a lot of, you know, quote, sustainable projects that were not actually even meaningful. It's not enough to be sustainable or to have a low CO2 footprint. It has to have importance. I mean, if you want to build something, it has to be important for community, for context.
Yeah, no, it's not banal at all. I really, really appreciate that. It's about meaning. It's not just about kind of ticking technical boxes,
no.
But it's to kind of to think beyond like the briefing, probably. And what you were saying about resources is something that I also really appreciate. It's taking care of how we extract resources, how we turn them into product systems, how we operate them, how we take them back into cycles. I mean, there's that old thing that now everyone talks about, but I mean, resources are not renewable. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, designers, architects, but also engineers, planners need to deal with those resources carefully. And that's what we haven't been doing probably in the past. And again, that's where I also see that architects with their kind of with their education could gain more influence. They could kind of really drive that agenda and really kind of also focus on that aspect. So if you look at the, let's say, the role of architects and practitioners and maybe also the architecture domain in the future, what do you think? I mean, how will this business evolve and how will it adapt to the changing context?
I find it very difficult to look into the future in that sense, because in a way the future is neutral. You know, it is what we actually do right now is going to be the future, and I think that's very important to understand. You know, instead of predicting trends, I think that understanding that we as architects, and I guess also in every related business, also clients, has the possibility of shaping the future. When you look at architecture as a business, I think there will be more and more, you could say, larger companies, because you would need to have more knowledge inside the companies on one hand. On the other hand, there's for me a great fear that architecture will become very impersonal, very technical, ticking off boxes. What I find important is in a way to find that balance between value, architectural quality, artistic value, you could say, and being responsible.
I like that, what you were saying, that we can actively shape the future that we want to have, that is preferable for us. I agree 100%. That's what we should be doing, and we shouldn't wait. Yes. And that obviously has also a lot to do, coming to your point of larger practices. I agree with that. I also see that. At the same time, I also see very promising kind of smaller practices researching, experimenting, piloting, because that will also remain quite a strong aspect, no, mm-hmm. that we need to, because no one has all the answers now, and we need to innovate quite a lot.
Yes.
And in our industry, the architecture, engineering, construction industry, is not necessarily designed to innovate.
No.
Because there's a cost pressure, there's time pressure, there's risk averseness. And I wonder who will be those innovators and who will do the experiments. And again, that's why I could see architects and design practitioners that really have the courage to rethink things, to test new materials, to, I don't know, go back to the lab and use renewable materials in a different way. Do you also see that angle?
In some ways I do. And if I look at it with a positive mind, I think there is a lot of interesting smaller offices doing experiments. If I'm negative, I would say yes, but the strange thing to me is that they actually work with concrete. They work with a lot of labor. In a way, they're not really addressing the issues. Strangely enough, I think a lot of the very artistically interesting offices are totally ignoring sustainability, which I find very strange, because there seems to be kind of a division between artistically interesting offices and the issues they address. The worst thing that could happen is that you have small offices that are doing really architecturally interesting work, but without addressing any of the big issues. And then there's the large offices that are actually building 99% of everything in a high sort of technical way, but without any architectural quality. You know, when you look at some of the interesting work that are being published, strangely enough, a lot of it is in concrete. It's not it's in situ cast. It's actually using, you know, if you go all the way through the process, it's using very, very badly paid labor. So there's a lot of issues here that, you know, architects usually, or in the old days, addressed, that I don't think is being addressed with the offices that are actually experimenting.
Yeah, interesting. So I think that's something that might evolve over time, because the pressure on resources, on climate, on labor shortage will even become bigger, I guess, no? And if we don't hit our climate targets until 2030, also national governments will probably release much more onerous policies. And that will ultimately also impact on the day-to-day practice. So that's why I also see that, you know, the faster we move, the better. So we cannot afford to take another year or years.
No.
But that's why I'm so glad to see your office, your kind of practice, and also the projects that you discussed, because they seem to have that attitude and that meaning that you were saying. And I also see that you are addressing those challenges, which is fantastic. And I also believe we have to accept that ambiguity for quite a while, that no one has all the answers.
Yeah.
But still, it's important that everyone is somehow moving to the right direction. And with that, we already came to an end of this podcast, Daughter. I really,
oh, really?
Appreciate your thoughts and also your open view on it. And maybe towards the listeners, if you have comments or feedback that is related to this podcast, feel free to get in touch with us. You will find the contact details in the show notes. So again, many thanks, Daughter Manrup, for that conversation.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.